Today is Thursday, April 12th, 2018. It's 9:31 a.m., so I apologize for starting late. This is panel number 4006, Drought, Disease, and Pollution. Does it cross borders or something to that effect? With that out of the way, I want to introduce myself first. My name is Carl Tinsman. I'm a resident of Boulder and of France. I'm a 30-year career retired international civil servant from the United Nations. I spent half my life in war zones delivering humanitarian assistance, and at the end of my career, I was a polio eradicator. And I continue to do polio eradication work across the world in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nigeria, Kenya, Somalia, etc. So that's who I am. The speakers that we have today, the panelists, you all have the program or you have the app, so I'm not going to repeat the stuff that's in there. But I would like just to say 30 seconds of words on each one of them, starting with Dr. Francisco Zamora on my left. Francisco is on the staff of the Sonoran Institute, has been on the staff for over 15 years. And he has been what I would consider the consummate integrationist of the Colorado River Delta, integrating overall environmental concerns across local communities, state governments, regional authorities, and two national governments. So to integrate all those people around environmental concerns is a real achievement, and we're looking very much forward to what Francisco has to say. I really wish my uncle was here. My uncle was the head of the Lower Colorado River Authority at one point about 25 years ago, and I wish he was here to hear you. Alex Verbeek, on the far end, lives in Stockholm. He's an environmental activist par excellence. He has a unique ability to describe the impact of climate change issues in ways that you not only can understand, but you will be inspired and moved to take action. You're going to see him here, but you can also follow him on Twitter, and you can see him on a YouTube speech that he did, I don't know exactly when it was, in the last year or two. That's an excellent description of environmental issues. So we're really pleased to have Alexander here. And then finally, last but not least, but perhaps the most interesting guy up here, Michael Johnson. Dr. Michael Johnson, not a medical doctor, but a PhD kind of doctor in biochemistry. But he arrived there at this PhD by way of a Bachelor of Arts degree in music. When our program committee meets to choose the panelists and design the panels, we thought we were getting a twofer. We thought he would play in the jazz concert, and then we could also use him to speak.
Nobody told me to bring the trumpet.
I'm sorry?
Nobody told me to bring the trumpet.
But yes, so he didn't have his trumpet. He didn't play in the jazz concert, but he's with us here today, and we're very pleased about that. So those are our three panelists. We're going to have them speak, each one of them, for 8, 9, 10 minutes max. If they try to go longer than that, then I will stop them. I don't think we're going to have that problem, but I always have my yellow card and my red card, just like we use in Europe in playing soccer. So they're each going to speak for 8 or 9 minutes and then comment on each other, and then we'll go to questions. So I believe we said that Alex would start. So Alex, the floor is yours.
Thank you and welcome everybody. And yeah, just like you said, I'm happy to see so many students in the room as well, both upstairs and downstairs. And I will talk louder, and when I don't do that, just do this or shout louder, because I tend to move back from the microphone. So I'll try to stay close. And I'll put on the timer on my telephone, otherwise I might talk too long. So if you look at the history of international relations, and I've been a diplomat for a long time, so I do that a lot, you normally see that the problems spread much faster over the borders than the solutions. And normally as diplomats, you try to prevent that happening, whatever the problem is. But in practice, you often find that diplomats are more like a kind of fire brigade solving problems that ran out of hand and became kind of a cross-border international problem. I'm sure that Carl will have a lot of experience in that field as well. Unfortunately, we find that increasingly the kind of international problems that we're dealing with don't have an easy solution. They're often interlinked with all kinds of other problems. It's a kind of multi-headed dragon. If you cut off one head, it doesn't solve the problem. You have to tackle them all at once in an integrated way. Drought, diseases, and pollution, they don't stop at the border, and they are also integrated as a problem to each other, as well as linked to other problems. So if you go back in history, you see that there was international cooperation between countries. If you go far back in history, there was always trade and travel, etc. But there was just zero cooperation on diseases spreading across the border. So in the 14th century, when you had the plague, it came all the way from China across Central Asia to Istanbul, and from there, or Constantinople, I should say, and from there, it spread over Europe and killed between 30% and 60% of the population. Some cities were actually completely wiped out. There was an international problem. There was no kind of lookalike of the World Health Organization or something that coordinated action, and that countries did not work together to share knowledge or to tackle the problem in any other way. What you also see is that until the Second World War, victims died more of microbes that were introduced by the enemy than actually by the warfare. So we were actually, until the Second World War, we were kind of doing biological warfare instead of anything else, unknowingly, kind of. If you look at the introduction of smallpox in the New World, complete civilizations were wiped out with smallpox, in most cases also unknowingly introduced. In some terrible, much worse cases, they were knowingly introduced. So if you quickly move forward in history, you look at our situation today in a much more globalized world, you see that we deal with new challenges. If a disease can now, a new pandemic can spread extremely rapidly because everybody is flying everywhere. But there's also good news. So the problem is maybe spreading faster, but we have better international cooperation. There is now something like the World Health Organization. Countries meet, experts meet, etc. So the game has changed, but it's certainly not won by either the bacteria or the humans. So if you look at the spreading of SARS in 2003, there was suddenly this scare that started in Southeast Asia. Within 5 weeks, there were 26 countries in all continents were affected by the SARS epidemic, and just by really rapid action and really good coordination internationally, and maybe the luck that the thing started off in Hong Kong and not just next door in southeastern China, we managed collectively to contain it. The damage was already, it's estimated between $30 and $140 billion. By only this contained SARS epidemic. Imagine we had not contained it. It would have been a worldwide disease. What would have happened then? So we often talk about climate change kind of problems, but something like a new pandemic is a very serious thing we should also reckon with. We will get a new pandemic. We just don't know when, where, and in what form, but we have to be prepared as well as we could. A globalization of problems needs globalized solutions. We have now left the Holocene, where for the past 10,000 years, in very stable conditions, we were able to build the human culture as we know it today. We're now in the Anthropocene. That is a new geological era. It's the age of man. It is where, for the first time, where people have changed the geological and environmental conditions on this planet in such a way that the whole planet is rapidly changing. We have taken over the helm of what happens on this planet, but we're a bit like, you know, we're not very good at it. So we are in charge, but we don't know what to do. That happens in more places, by the way. So there's no learning on the job. We just have one planet. There's the talk you hear of moving to another planet is absolute nonsense. It won't happen. Our population in the world grows with 210,000 people every day. If you want to send them to a rocket, with a rocket to another planet, which you don't know how to fit those people in, you still have the other people that are left on this planet. So that's complete nonsense. We have to do it on this planet. So why are we not good at controlling the planet? It's because we don't cooperate well. The knowledge is there. Scientists know. They don't know everything how the planet functions, but in the past 2 decades, we have learned so much about how all these systems interact. You can say that we are able to do it if we would cooperate better. The other problem is often known as the tragedy of the commons. Everybody says somebody else should start first, another country should start first, or maybe your neighbor should start first. So when you're in the grocery store, you use that extra plastic bag, you don't grab it up when it blows out of your car, because it's just one plastic bag, right? And your neighbor should start with stop using plastic bags. So by 2050, there's more plastic in the ocean than fish. It's also that you do take that extra flight on your holiday destination. You know, it's cheap, it's subsidized, it's just one ticket, drop in the ocean, etc. But it all does contribute to drought. Dry regions in this planet are getting drier, wet regions are getting wetter. You see, just follow the newspapers, you see that there's now already so much more extreme weather in the world than just 5 years ago. It's rapidly increasing. This is the beginning of what all of you are going to experience in your lifetimes. And I see a lot of young people sitting here. This is so important for you to know that the life that you will lead on this planet, certainly after the year 2050, when my generation is gone, things will change so much. And it's your responsibility that in your lifetimes you try the utmost to do in your personal lives, or maybe in the position that you have, that you work on keeping this planet a livable planet. So you have to study, you have to inform yourself. You have to really know what you're doing, because so many people don't know what's happening on this planet. Yes, I'm looking at all you, and it's glad that you all look at me, and because I am addressing you. You are the next generation, you are the future. And I'm so glad that you're sitting here to listen in to these panels. And I think all kids should do that. And because problems are internationalizing. The first reflex that you see, and that's the last things I will say, see that I have 1.5 more minutes. But when problems are internationalizing, the first reflex is often that you want to close your eyes, and you want to close your ears, and you want to close the door, and you want to keep that problem on the other side of the door. And then, or on the other side of the border maybe, and you want to say to your friends and family that let's go back to the old days, you know, when life was so good, we didn't have these kind of problems. And we isolate her. And we're going to isolate ourselves from the rest. And you blame somebody else for those problems, and you see it everywhere. Just open a newspaper. This is the reaction that you see in a lot of countries and by a lot of people. And then people convince themselves that the science is not yet clear and that we still have time. And that is just not the way we should do it. The truth is that for all these problems, they don't stop at the border. You have to talk to each other. You have to talk to other countries across the border. You have to work together to tackle these problems. You have to share your knowledge. You need an international outlook. You have to cooperate with other countries. And as a last line, because I'm reaching my 9.5 minutes here, looking at your generation, try somewhere in your education to spend some time abroad. Get to know other countries. Other cultures, other people are affected by decisions you take in this country and the other way around. And the one big planet that we used to have in the past is actually a small planet because it's so connected. So get to know the other sides of the planet as well, in the north and south. Try to build it somewhere into your education and make it a better planet for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex. Who's going next?
I can go.
Yeah.
Michael, please.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. So I want to start off by saying, by talking about something, I guess, a little bit random, and it's kind of how I got into the social media activism that I'm currently doing, you know, as far as trying to be a scientific communicator. Mm-hmm. It's relevant, I promise. So a friend of mine sent an email around to you know, his family, and he included me on it, and they were talking about how microbiomes work. And I don't know if, how many of you all are actually familiar with microbiomes. There's lots of biomes, you know, but we were speaking more of the ones in the gut. You have all these good bacteria that help protect you against bad bacteria or help break down food. You also have microbiomes on your skin, in your hair, in your lungs. I mean, microbiomes are kind of everywhere. And the argument was kind of like, well, what are, you know, if we're comparing microbiomes of today, you know, we just are, you know, just sicker today than we were before, or, and I kind of wanted to say, wait a minute. Let's actually look at this problem. Let's look at, let's try and think about what microbiomes are today versus what microbiomes were 50 years ago, which, to truth be told, we actually don't really know. We hardly know what's in your microbiome now. We're just at the tip of the iceberg as far as trying to figure out what some of these bacteria do. But what I did say to them is that the microbiome of 50 years ago, I mean, there was a lot less globalization the further back you go, of course. Like, we're becoming more and more globalized. There are more and more blurred lines. So because of the people that you communicate with today, the rooms that you sit in, the people that you talk to, I think there's a lot, I mean, that our microbiome is kind of evolving. Now, why does that matter? It's because we're finding out that the microbiome is protecting us against different types of diseases, different types of getting different allergies, different autoimmune diseases. And so it's this really kind of globalization of these particular bacteria within you that is actually leading to modulation of other diseases and how we carry them. So that's kind of one thing. So what I do is I work in infectious disease. I try to find new and novel cures for different bacteria. The one that I work on currently is Streptococcus pneumoniae. Now we'll call it Strep pneumo or pneumococcus. You might have heard of the pneumococcal vaccine. It kills about 22,000 people in the U.S., but 1.5 million worldwide. Again, we do have a vaccine, but that vaccine only covers about 25% of the types of this particular bacteria. They have these things called serotypes. Think of them as, I'm looking out into the audience, I see a lot of different color shirts. Well, we have a vaccine that maybe recognizes a certain color of a certain shirt. We need something that's more broad to that. And what we've shown is that with some of these particular bacteria, I mean, and we looked at what the most virulent or the most disease-causing versions of the Streptococcus pneumoniae that there were, and we put them in this vaccine, but some of the other versions of that particular bacteria are now becoming more antibiotic resistant. So you have this environment in some countries where there's a lot of this particular pathogenesis, specifically in third world countries. Half of the people under of that 1.5 million number are actually under the age of 5. And I know I'm like, you know, we're just doom and gloom up here so far, but, you know, I think there is hope in the future for that, and I will get to that as well. But we're starting to see some upregulation of antibiotic resistance in some of these strains. Now, what's to stop it from going across the border? They don't need their passports. They just keep going, right? So how does that work with certain emerging diseases as well? So, you know, if this is kind of your immune system, you have basically a threshold. So we have things, you know, that came here like smallpox that goes above your immune system's ability to fight it off and you don't have a good day. There are certain things that are right out about it. You get really sick, but you end up fighting it off. And then some things that you're a carrier for. I'm gonna use some cups here. So there are some things that actually can't actually bind to you because some of the proteins in you don't work. But some people, it can bind just fine. And the people who are carriers and they don't get infected, they can still carry it with them to somebody like me who it can bind very well. So trying to guard against some of these diseases that are on the border are kind of important. So we have these things called emerging diseases. We have things that we kind of know about. I would argue that there are so many, we knew about Zika before. We knew about some of these Ebola before. It's just that they became more in the media. So now we're like, oh, let's throw money at it. And we've actually found some treatments for Zika. So we do have the ability to adapt to some of these bad bacteria, bad viruses, bad fungal organisms, bad parasites, parasites being malaria. There's even like some drugs that they can give people that actually poisons your blood against the mosquitoes that carry malaria. So this is research that's happening right now. These are some of the things that we can do to overcome some of these problems. There is hope. There are things that we can do. But So how else do these, you know, the microbiome kind of play a role in some of these diseases? Well, a lot of, again, I kind of gave you the cup example, and sometimes that cup example can, you know, if we actually give you an antibiotic, we lower the threshold of the bacteria, but then they can become antibiotic resistant. We give another antibiotic. So basically, you stay here, and we're fighting on this particular plane trying to find new therapeutics, and then the pathogen evolves, so we die. And then, so it just keeps going up and down. So that's literally the war that we're fighting right now in infectious disease. So going back to kind of your microbiome and why that's important, because it truly affects how you can fight off some of these particular pathogens. There was an example in Africa. There were two twins growing up in the same house, and one was malnourished and one was not. They ate the same things. What was different? It was their microbiome. When you actually took the microbiome of one and transplanted it to the one who was not getting the nutrition, back to normal. These are the things that we can do. These are the things that we can investigate. But we need people to do the research. We need people to support the research. We need buy-in. We need the community buy-in. We can't save the planet alone, just the people on this panel. We need people to be knowledgeable. Sometimes that comes into the, I think we as scientists, we have a problem in communicating our science to the public. I think we're very much public servants. We get on, you know, this kind of, this has kind of been one of my soapbox issues this whole week. We get on kind of this ivory tower where, oh, you're not going to understand what we're talking about. And then we have the public to say, oh, I'm not going to understand what you're talking about. I think we need to change that. I think we need to break down our language, not dumb it down, because that's implying the wrong thing. We need to be able to communicate our research in a better way. And there are some fabulous people at this conference that are absolutely doing that. But it needs to happen at a larger scale. But the same thing, I think everybody has a responsibility to not be willfully ignorant. There is ignorance, and that's fine. We've made ignorance into a bad word. It's fine to not know something about a topic, but you all are doing the right thing. You're here, you're trying to find out more information about things. But I think we have a dangerous problem where we try to remain willfully ignorant. Oh, that's not my problem today. I'm gonna compartmentalize. Oh, you know, I wish things could go back to what they were, exactly as Alexander was saying. I'll close by saying this. As bad as some of the things that, you know, we are and kind of will talk about sound, there is hope, there is time, but we need buy-in from everyone.
Thank you very much, Michael. And Francisco next.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for being here, especially the students. I see kind of your faces. I see my son. My son is 13 years old. And my daughter is 24 years old. And, you know, by looking at you, I remember when I was growing up in Mexico City. I grew up in Mexico City. And I was Sundays watching Jacques Cousteau documentaries. I don't know what you are actually watching now, but at that time, you know, Jacques Cousteau and all his trips all over the world. And so that's why I'm here. You know, I became an oceanographer. And later, I decided to, you know, not only to learn about the environment, but to do something about it, try to help. I think Alex mentioned that you guys are the new generation. There is an old proverb that I don't know exactly the words, but it's not that the previous generations are passing on, you know, the environment to the new generations. This old proverb says that we kind of borrow the environment and the earth from future generations. And that will give you a different perspective. Like you guys, when you know are playing and you have a bike, do you have a bike or Xbox maybe? You know, and then a friend of you asks you to borrow that, the bike or anything, you know. What is your expectation? Your expectation is that he will take care of that. And hopefully we'll return it in the same condition or perhaps even a better condition, right? Right? So that, you know, when I heard that, that really changed. Well, it didn't change. It just kind of realized that, oh, yeah, that's a different perspective, and that's what we need to do. So in that context, you are the current generation, not only the kind of the future. You think about you and everyone here as the generation that borrow the land, the resources from future generations, and we have a responsibility to return it in the same, hopefully in a better condition that it is now. So, you know, in that context, cooperation, we have been talking about cooperation. I'm gonna just use a specific example of cooperation in terms of hopefully something that you are more familiar with, the Colorado River. Are you familiar with the Colorado River? We're in Colorado, right? So the Colorado River, you know, traveled from the Rockies all the way to the Sea of Cortez. And in the 1990s, Mexico and the U.S. were talking about surplus. I mean, water, there were many wet years in the basin. There was a lot of water. The reservoirs were full. And U.S. and Mexico were talking about surplus, how to kind of allocate the surplus water, right? Well, now 15 years later, we are talking about drought, and we are not talking about surplus, we are talking about shortages, how we're gonna deal with the drought and the impacts of the shortage supply of water. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but Mexico is at the end of the Colorado River, and Mexico only gets about 10% of the supply of the water. And just to give you a perspective, in the U.S., they take about 15 units or 15 million acre-feet of water. Mexico only gets 1.5. And both in the U.S. and Mexico, 80% of the water goes to agriculture, and the remaining goes to cities, and zero goes to the environment. So drought is a big concern now in the Colorado River. and not only, you know, for Mexico, but also for the U.S. And cooperation is critical to, you know, deal with the drought. And Mexico, I guess I'm glad to say that Mexico and the U.S. have been able to collaborate to prepare for potential impacts of the drought. And there have been many, many different actions, but there is, of course, a binational agreement in which Mexico and the U.S. have defined specific actions to deal with the drought. So there are different things, and one of those is, you know, water conservation. So when you take a shower tomorrow or later today, you know, make it 1 minute shorter. So use less water, because the drought is real. So it's not something that, you know, is out there and people talk about the drought. It's real. It's affecting a lot of people in the basin, and again, both the U.S. and Mexico. So that's just one example of cooperation in terms of the drought in the Colorado River. I want to talk a little bit about pollution, and since the title of the presentation is you know, this pollution, drought, and disease don't stop at the border, I want to talk about the border a little bit, you know, the U.S. and Mexican border. And sometimes we think, you know, that the drought, as an example, the drought is actually kind of the impacts of the drought in the Colorado River Basin is impacting Mexico. 95% of the basin is on the U.S. side. So what happens on the U.S. has an impact on Mexico. But in terms of pollution, you know, it's sad, I guess, to say, but some of the rivers that cross from the Mexican side to the U.S. side, and in particular the New River, there is a New River that crosses from Mexico in the Mexicali area. It crosses to the U.S. and goes to the Salton Sea. I don't know if you have heard about the Salton Sea, but it's an example of a river that is very polluted and is a concern from both countries, and is just another issue that both countries are trying to deal with. Just to give you an example, the Border Patrol in the Yuma, El Centro area in California doesn't allow the officers to go into the river or to, you know, to touch the water. Why? Because the pollution. So when they are trying to, you know, people are trying to cross, you know, using the river, they just have to wait, you know, outside the river. And if they, you know, capture someone, the first thing they do, they take them to the doctor, because they have been in the water for hours, maybe days. It's just, you know, again, it's sad that we got to that point, but I wanted to emphasize or highlight the cooperation again. So Mexico and the U.S. have been dealing with this issue and trying to cooperate. And on the Mexican side, there has been investment in water treatment, wastewater treatment, because the main source of the pollution there was raw sewage going to the river. So these are some issues that at the more local level or the basin level, you know, the Colorado River and the drought, the pollution of the New River coming from Mexico to the U.S., and how we need to, U.S. and Mexico countries need to be able to talk about it and cooperate and try to fix these issues. So I'm going to stop there. There's, you know, more things to say. So I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Francisco, very much. We're going to very quickly get on to questions here. And I regret to advise you that the app does not seem to be working. So I would ask that all of your questions be written questions on the index cards. We have two producers here, Jim Lewis who is upstairs, I think.
Down here,
sorry. Jim Lewis has cards, and our other producer is Michael Ryan, who is upstairs. So if you have a question, raise your paw, and you will get an index card. Just write down the questions, then they'll bring them to me. If you are a student, indicate that you are a student, because students will get preference in terms of asking questions. Now, while you're doing that, preparing your questions, we're just going to have a very quick round of comments from our panelists on what each other has said, and I want to kick it off with all the panelists with a question for them. Francisco has reminded us that my generation, we are really the stewards of the earth. We are the caretakers for future generations, and I would submit that my generation is failing at this task, in my opinion. The question that I would ask to our panelists, I heard a very famous environmentalist once say, there's two things everybody should do. One is become a vegetarian, and the second is ride a bicycle instead of driving a car. And I would like to pose to the panelists, what are things that we should all be doing? Do you agree with those two? And what are other things that we should all be doing to preserve our planet? And in addition, you can comment on each other's presentations.
Thank you. To start with your question, it's yes and yes. I'm a vegetarian and I ride a bicycle. I'm Dutch, so of course I ride a bicycle. And we do it without a helmet. For me, it's quite funny. But you young guys, use a helmet, please. Why am I a vegetarian? For a few reasons. First of all, now that in the world, rapidly more and more people are going to lead the kind of good life that we lead. You call that the world middle class. People that they drive a car, they take a hot shower, they put on the heating or the air conditioning increasingly. That's the world middle class. The number of people in the world middle class, you're all world middle class. The number of people in the world that are part of the world middle class is more than doubling in just 20 years' time. It goes from a bit more than 2 billion to a bit less than 5 billion between 2009 and 2030. And all of these people will need resources from this planet. They will need water and food and energy from this planet. They will consume and they will produce waste and they will produce also greenhouse gases that are changing our climate. If we want to feed the world by 2050, it is impossible that all of this 5 billion in the world middle class will be eating meat. You can simply make the calculation. There's not enough land in the world to produce all that food, because a lot of that food is meat. If everybody would live like the average American, we would need 5.5 planets. We have only one. We can still do it on this planet because so many people don't have the lifestyle that you have. So you need a lot of land and a lot of water to produce just 1 kilo of meat. You need like 5,000 liters of water to produce 1 kilo of meat. Another calculation is 15,000 liters of water. I don't know about gallons and pounds. That's up to you to recalculate. But it's a lot. If you put energy into a cow by feeding the cow corn or soy or whatever you feed the cow, you put in 32 times as much energy as that you get out of the energy once you eat the meat of the cows. It's a very wasteful thing. We are now ruining the rainforest in the world. We're cutting them off to grow animal food. And then we put a lot of that food in an animal, and then we eat that little meat that comes out of it. It's an extremely inefficient way. So that's one. Second reason, it's the animal welfare. It's so sad and horrible to look at how we are treating animals. We try not to look at these things because it's so horrible. Animals are supposed to be free, And especially cows and pigs and other mammals are really, really very intelligent. We're not that far off from them, although we look different. It's horrible how we use them. If you don't eat meat, you don't do that. Last reason, if you don't eat meat, you'll be more healthier. 15 years ago, I ate like many of you still do. I ate a lot of meat, etc. I cut eating meat, I stopped eating fish, and actually I stopped using all dairy products. And that's been a slow process for me. I feel so much better, and if you just Google at the data on your health, the chance that you will get cancer or that you will get heart disease is so much less if you don't eat meat. These are three good reasons not to do it. And on the bicycle, I'm talking too long. On the bicycle, please don't use a car. I have a car. It's 20 years old. I drive so seldom in the car. Maybe twice a month, for just for 20 minutes to pick up my daughter if she's further away. For the rest, I do everything in my life with public transport, with walking and cycling. And it makes me much healthier as well. And I don't pollute the atmosphere. So I'll stop there. I won't have questions for the rest because I'm talking too long. Sorry.
Michael.
Guilty and guilty. you know, I guess I'm rooting for lab-grown meat, maybe. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things that I do wrestle with. I don't know if you all saw the keynote, but I can't wait to stop driving. You know, have, you know, the autonomous vehicles taking me from work to home. You know, sometimes, you know, we just are so spread out that to fit all these people who collaborate in one small concentrated area, or they need to kind of go further out, you do need a second mode of transportation, unfortunately. But if we could do a ride share thing, hey, I hate driving. I can't wait to take that away. You know, please. Riding up the mountain to get to my house. Ooh. Maybe I need to give up meat to be more healthy so I have the endurance to make it up there.
Very good.
Electric bikes.
Electric. Well, you know, there are electric bikes. There are electric skateboards. And I'm just like, that dude never put his foot down to keep up. Oh, you know. I do want to talk about one thing that you can do. You know, because you mentioned like meat, you mentioned, you know, riding a bike. One thing you can do to help public health is, and this might, I've heard that this can be a hot topic inside of Boulder, but vaccinations. Certain diseases do cross borders, and you know, you feel like you eradicate it, and then things start coming back. That's not good. I mean, and we have a group of people who, you know, as scientists, I think we need to kind of say, well, you know, not be like the, you need to do this, you need to do this, but we need to be more open and actually say, well, what concerns do you have? How can we address them? You know, how, you know, but again, it kind of goes back to that willful ignorance point that I made earlier. There's a lot that's trying to be done as far as vaccine research for different things, for like Zika. I mean, for sometimes we don't have good systems to grow certain viruses or bacteria in. They only are host adapted, which means they grow in people, and we're not going to experiment on people because that's bad. You know, things like flu, we've shown that, you know, over 90% of people who die from flu weren't vaccinated. We've shown protection that builds up from year to year to year. The concerns about some of the things that go in some of the vaccines are not an issue. As far as they're literally just not put in these vaccines anymore. I think that's one of the things that, you know, if we come up with a treatment, we're trying to be civil servants. We're trying to be as helpful as we can be. If you find me a biomedical scientist that went in it for the glitz and the glamour and the fame, let me know, because I want to meet that person. I went into it because I just truly cared about helping people, and I mean that's where it's. I can't speak for everyone, but that's where it's really coming from. The other thing with that, on top of the vaccines, I will say antibiotic resistance. If you get a full course of antibiotics, please take it, because that if you don't, that could build up more antibiotic resistant bacteria in you. If you have a sore throat, it might be a virus. Guess what? Viruses aren't killed by antibiotics. Just putting that out there. You know, there's a, I guess there's a certain responsibility for us to actually maintain ourselves better. And that comes to be, you know, like giving up meat, exercising more, not getting heart disease, because these are also economic burdens that will take money away from doing research to help save the planet.
I'm just going to say a few words. I'm trying to eat less tacos.
That helps.
Well, thank all three of you, and especially Francisco for being so brief. That's wonderful. I've got about 10 or 12 questions up here, and I'm going to give students priority, and I'm going to also try to combine them as best I can. So the first one, and this is a combination of questions. What do we need to emphasize in our educational system to enhance coordinated, integrated problem solving? And also, you say, and this is directed to Alex, you say that we need to work together to stop drought, disease, and pollution. But that is an easy way to shut out the real questions, isn't it? Okay. And finally, are you optimistic that we will be capable of a united global cooperation to combat these issues? Or do you see a continued shift to nationalism and isolation in the future? So this is for any or all the panelists to comment on. I would request that you keep your answers relatively brief, like 2 minutes or less.
Yeah, I'll just say something about the first question about cooperation. In terms of education, I think exposing students to environmental issues, and not only in the class but outside, that's a key thing to do. In the work I do, because in this case in Mexico, Colorado River, there is no water, there is no river. When you ask people, students, hey, have you been, or do you know about the Colorado River? They don't know because they haven't experienced that. And you know, I mentioned that I'm here because Jacques Cousteau and all the, you know, documentaries, and then later I was able to go fishing, camping. So education, please, you know, bring students to experience nature. And I know here in the U.S. that's done. In some other areas, is not done because. One, because there is the environment, there is no nature, there is no river, so we need to restore and bring students to reconnect with nature.
I'm not sure what was hinted at, what is the real question. For me, the real question is, and maybe the one that asked the question meant something else. For me, the real question is, how do we prevent that climate change is getting worse where we are now, and preferably, how can we get it back? How do we save our planet? And when you deal with that question, you can basically split it in two things. One is you have to avoid that it gets worse, and the best thing you could do is to stop as soon as possible using fossil fuels. They are the main reason for the increase in CO2, and the increase in CO2 is the main reason, but again, not the only reason, for why we have these terrible predictions about what climate change is going to do to us. And in the past 5 years or so, increasingly in the US and already longer in the rest of the world, you can see the damage that it's doing. This is the beginning. So stopping more climate change, that is something very important to work on. You also have to look at all kinds of other things like agriculture for deforestation, etc. The other thing you have to do, and that's part of the real question, is adaptation. For a long time, we only focused on not having more greenhouse gases. But by now, since we are in this state that the climate is changing, we have to adapt. So the kind of work that both of the other two panelists are doing is both related to that. because we will see, because of climate change, more spreading of diseases, we will experience more droughts. Dry regions are getting drier. Imagine the Colorado River. I guess many of you must have seen the Grand Canyon. That Grand Canyon was shaped over, I think, the past 6 million years by a river that now doesn't even have the power to reach the Sea of Cortez anymore. It just stops somewhere in the desert. Imagine that what is changing on this planet. So the other part of the question on international cooperation, yes, that has for a long time, it actually still is my job as a diplomat, now kind of former diplomat, in my independent role that I have now. I've worked on that for many years. Two things I want to mention there. In late 2015, you saw all over the world that countries cooperated together on the big challenges of our lifetime. And two things that are very well known is the climate agreement that was agreed in Paris in late 2015, where all countries in the world promised to each other that they would do their utmost to avoid the planet getting warmer than 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius. And the other thing that we agreed to in the same period was an agenda for the next 15 years. It's called the Agenda 2030. In the United Nations, all the countries in the world agreed that we would work on 17 very important goals. We call them the global goals or the sustainable development goals. And they are about water, about food, about energy. We need peace. We need, so I'm not going to mention all 17, but these are the 17 essential things that all of us in the world should work on. I think it's important that countries agreed that they would work on this, and they would work together on this. Unfortunately, quickly after we had that international agreement, in quite a few countries in the world, we got populist, nationalistic leaders that deny science, that only look at their own short-term interests. And these people are responsible for ruining our planet for our children and grandchildren. And it's horribly sad to see that just a few people in leadership roles are not taking the responsibility that is given to them by the people that voted to them. And in some cases, nobody ever even voted for them. Thank you.
So I see, going back to the students in the audience, when you're doing a paper for class, where do you get your information from? Just shout it out, say some. The internet, where on the internet? Google, is there a specific site that you'll go to more often than others to find out relevant information? Well, one day you will. One day there will be some of these sites where you'll go to. When I'm a scientist, I put out my information into the literature. It is definitely under scrutiny by other scientists in my field. And when I make a statement that they haven't heard of, that's not general knowledge, they'll say one thing: cite your source. So what I'm going to tell you all and tell everyone here is, when you're looking at information and somebody says, oh, but I found this out, or this is this story, cite your source. I think if we were able to cite our source a lot better, and we held people accountable to that, a lot more, or there'd be a lot less spread of misinformation. And if we can actually have the right information at the table, then we can do a lot better in helping the goals of the world.
Okay, the next set of questions is for Francisco. And again, they're from students, or some of them are from students. The first one of the three is, we know the problems, what are some solutions to the world's water shortages? And as a segue from that, if the drought is real, why do we allow continued development? If I save water, doesn't that just help someone in a new home development, maybe in Denver? And finally, Again, from a student. Do you think that desalinization is a realistic option on an increasing scale? Do you think that the Red Sea-Dead Sea Canal will set any sort of positive precedent?
Well, I'll try to be brief. Solutions, well, yeah, we are all about trying to find solutions, and solutions are at different levels. You know, some are short-term, mid-term, and of course some have impact on the long-term. Water conservation, let me just say, water conservation, there are different ways in which we can do a better job in the way we use water. At home, in agriculture, in the industry, at all levels, I think water conservation is important. When I take a shower, I put a bucket and to capture, you know, that water at the beginning, and then I reuse that water. It's, you know, a minor thing, but, you know, in fact, I get in trouble with my wife because I'm always asking, hey, don't use that much water, turn off the light, don't drive too much, let's go together. So, yeah, there are solutions and, you know, at different levels. So you guys could actually implement some of those solutions. And, of course, at the government level, federal level, and the state level, it's important to look at not only short-term, but, you know, also the long-term needs and impacts and solutions. Desalination, yes, I think it is an option. It's being used in many countries in for many years. I guess what I would like to say is also, well, just be careful where you put the desalting plant. And of course, it uses a lot of energy too. So, you know, what type of energy you are using to operate the plant. Are you putting the wastewater into an estuary or into a biosphere reserve? Like now there are, well, proposals to put a desalting plant in the upper Gulf of California. And, you know, the Gulf of California is a very sensitive environment and very productive. So putting a desalting plant there may not be the best option. So where you put it, I think, is and the energy that you, the type of energy that you use is important. So I guess I just end by saying water conservation, use less water or use it and, wisely, and I think it will be very important.
Anybody else want to comment on that one? Okay, I just make a quick comment myself. We need creative solutions to water conservation. For example, I was visiting some friends in Australia a couple years ago, and I went to the toilet, and then I washed my hands. And where I washed my hands, the wastewater from washing my hands then drained directly into the toilet.
Oh yeah.
So that the water could be reused to flush the toilet. A very simple thing, but I've only seen that in one place in the world. And I'm sure there are a lot of other creative solutions that probably younger people could come up with to invent ways that we can save water and solve some of these other problems. Yes, question number next. This one is for Michael from a student. It says, in your opinion, how can you maintain or boost your microbiome health? Are probiotics helpful? There seems to be a very divided opinion on probiotics.
What a wonderful question. Are probiotics helpful? My statement to that is they are not hurtful. And in some cases, and like after an antibiotic course, taking them can actually get you back on the right course. A lot of the microbiome, you know, things do repopulate within your body. Maybe the taking a probiotic actually can jumpstart it. Eating yogurt also helps. But yeah, so say the first part of the question one more time for me, please. Sorry.
Yeah, in your opinion, can you maintain or boost, how can you maintain or boost your microbiome health?
So there's, as scientists, we're trying to figure out what exactly is in the microbiome that is super helpful. I'll give you one really cool example. There's a strain of E. coli that it was called E. coli Nissl. It was actually the 100th anniversary of this particular bacteria. You know, these soldiers came back from war. One person wasn't sick while all of his mates were from salmonella poisoning. It turned out that this one E. coli, which we generally think as, oh, E. coli is bad. No, there are plenty types of good E. coli. It was actually fighting for nutrients against the salmonella to actually save the person from getting sick. We're still finding out about cool stuff like this. So as far as like really boosting your microbiome, you know, there's not too much we can do to absolutely boost it until we figure out exactly what's in it. We do know that a good diversity of foods actually boosts it. I mean, like, so if you're eating a lot of, there are certain processed foods that can affect it. There's, you know, they'll call them sugar-free. Well, guess what? It's still a sugar. Just because your body doesn't use it doesn't mean that bacteria can't. And that actually does affect how your microbiome interacts with your body as well. Yeah, it's like drives me crazy. Sugar-free? No, it's, if you look at the chemical structure, it's literally a sugar. Soapbox, sorry. So, you know, it's when you eat a balanced diet, it does actually impact your microbiome. And I think that, you know, eating less processed foods actually does, from what we've seen, improve the health via a more diversity of bacteria in your microbiome. So that's one thing that I suppose that you could do.
Okay, thank you. We've got time, I think, only for one last question. I apologize to those of you whose questions I haven't got to. But this is a cry for help, and therefore I want to pose it to all three panelists. And it says, and I quote, "When looking at websites that calculate energy use for my life, I would have to live in a tent and grow all of my own food and walk and even breathe less. I can't see that this is at all possible for any U.S. citizen to do. So what do you advise?" Alex, you want to go first?
Just don't read that website. Because it's nonsense. I mean, if we want a stable way of living for everybody on this planet, we need to have the lifestyle that we had, let's say, in the 1970s. Of course, not in everything, you never go back in time, but just as a kind of indication, which basically the lifestyle that I had as a kid, I had a wonderful life. I was breathing as much as I liked of the wonderful clean air that we had in those days, which was not really true. We had some bad air as well, too. But those were different problems. So it is, many people are out there out of self-interest or the interest of their companies to tell you that you have to give up so much and that it's kind of impossible to have a more sustainable planet. Actually, the experts that whose job it is to study this and come with advice, and they mention their sources as they should, they say that we only give up something like 3% of our GDP. So that's a GDP, that's basically everything that we earn together in a country, right? On the other hand, if you compare it to the kind of losses that we are going to expect if we don't act as we should. It's predicted by the World Bank that by 2050, and it's less far away than you think, it's just 32 years from now, that by 2050, there's many countries in the world that will lose like 6% of their GDP because we didn't take action. So the answer is extremely simple. We have to change some things in our lives, but that is not drastic. We can all still lead a perfectly wonderful life. Actually, we can live more healthy and happy if we do take the right decisions. And since this is the last time that I will be speaking, just a last minute to all the young people, and I'm so happy that you are here. I was recently, sometimes I'm like you, sitting in the audience, listening to somebody. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to Alex Stubb, the former Prime Minister of Finland. And he's an extremely fit, healthy guy. And you don't often see that among leaders of countries. And he said that the rules that he lives by is one hour of exercise every day, 1 hour of reading a book every day, not something online, but a real book instead of articles. And the third 1 hour, that's a limitation, that is social media, not more than 1 hour of social media every day. I thought that was a very good way to keep in mind. The other one he added to it was sleep 8 hours every night. And last one that I add to it, and there I echo Francisco, spend more time in nature. Try at least every week to spend one or a few hours in nature. Living in Boulder, there's no better place in the world where you can live up to that commitment. So your 3 1-hours, right? Remember, exercise, reading a book, and no more than 1 hour social media. That's where I like to stop. I'm so happy that I see a young generation in this audience. Good luck.
When I went from elementary school to high school, I was like, wow, I had so much more time in elementary school. When I looked back at high school from college, I was like, wow, I had so much time when I was in high school. And at every single step of my life, I basically look back at the time before, and it's like, wow, I had so much more time then. I'm sure they'll get to a point in my life where I'll have a little bit more free time once, you know, the kids can do their own homework and all that stuff. But the point that I'm trying to get to here is it was a lesson in efficiency. And I think that we need to, as a society, become more efficient. And that's echoing basically everything that has been said as far as conservation is concerned. But one of the things, again, how you can become more efficient is what goes into you and how you perceive the world. So what information are you taking in, and how are you perceiving that? And it again goes back to the, you know, really guard the sources, guard yourself against the sources where you get some of the information get some of your information from. Make sure it's a good place. Make sure that it's respected by experts in the field, people who are actually doing the research, because that will lead you to, I guess, that efficiency. And that efficiency will lead to better problem solving in the future. And thanks for the opportunity.
Francisco, you have the last word in 1 minute.
Okay. And the word is dream. Especially you guys, dream about the future, dream about what you can do to live and to make a better future for, you know, the new generations. So you are the present and the future of this world. So dream about that, not only when you're asleep, but, you know, during the day. Dream about what you can do for the people in this planet.
What a wonderful ending. Thank you so much, Francisco. And thanks to all of the panelists. Another round of applause for the whole panel.